We've all been there before. When we were students, you'd hear those dreaded words, group project, and immediately you'd begin calculating the additional work that you would need to do just to keep the group afloat. And this was especially if the teacher chose the group members for you and you knew that you'd be stuck with kids you didn't like or that you didn't know or who simply didn't get things done. You would check the list of names on the board and you'd realize it. You will be with the drifter who wanders around the classroom chatting with friends. You'll have the needy student who wants to ask the teacher questions before making any decisions. And then you'll have the feisty fighter who picks arguments because he's bored. That was your group. But then something happened. Suddenly, you're a teacher and you see a new perspective with group work. The floater is actually avoiding work because she's scared of doing it wrong. She's been burned too many times in group projects where she tried to contribute, only to have other members redo her work for her or in some cases, tell her that it's not good enough, might as well give up. And that needy student, that student's also scared. Scared of getting it wrong, of doing something embarrassing, of letting down his teacher. You get the idea. And that feisty fighter has such a drive for autonomy and creativity and such potential to lead, but is still learning what it means to work collaboratively and to address people with kindness and tact. It's no wonder that you ended up doing all of the work when you were a kid. Group dynamics are hard. And it's no wonder that you end up with group dynamics in your own classroom where members split up or where one member does all the work and it gets frustrating. Again, collaborative work is hard, really hard, but it's also vital for life. Despite the myth of the lone artist or the inventor toiling away in isolation, creative work is almost always rooted in community. It's almost always tied to some aspect of collaboration. And if we want students to think like artists and engineers and architects and makers and problem solvers, well, then they're going to need to learn how to work collaboratively on projects. I find it interesting that when Google began Project Oxygen, they assumed that the best predictor of employee success would be university program and grades. That was the big assumption. But what they found was that their hypothesis was almost entirely wrong. Instead of it being all about degrees and diplomas, it was all about being a good coach, communicating, listening, possessing insights into others, valuing other people's viewpoints, having empathy toward one another. In other words, the most critical factors for success was basically the same list as what you would need to have good collaboration. Later, when they studied their teams in Project Aristotle, they found that the top skills were equality, generosity, curiosity toward ideas of your teammates, empathy, and emotional intelligence. Again, these were those so-called soft skills that are often aligned to collaboration. Now, I want to point this out. There's a blog post and a sketch video. If you go to SpencerVideos.com, I have like a little sketch video on the 7 keys to creative collaboration. I actually did a series last year on creative collaboration. But what I want to talk about is, how do we build the structures then that allow this type of collaborative work to thrive in project-based learning? If you're doing design thinking projects, what does it mean to structure things so that each group actually is able to thrive? And I think that the key ideas that we're going to get into are 3 major factors that I've noticed, 3 ways to boost this collaboration. So number 1 is actually the idea of beginning with ownership. So when I first attempted project-based learning, I created these hyper-detailed project directions, and I wanted every student to know exactly what they needed to do. If a student said, "I'm confused," I responded by adding more details. And what happened is I started to create better and better and better and better and better and better and better instructions. But then I realized something. My instructions weren't better. They were just longer, more detailed, more specific. And then I realized that my students were working for me rather than working for themselves. And every time I've done a meaningful collaborative project, I've either been working for myself or working for an audience, but I've rarely had those experiences when I was focused on a grade. The bottom line was, I needed to focus on student ownership. I love this quote from my friend Chris Lehman, who writes, if you assign a project and get back 30 of the exact same thing, that's not a project, that's a recipe. So that was my problem. I had created these recipes with the best of intentions. And over time, though, I shifted towards student ownership, and I began to encourage students to own the entire project process. Now, if you look at the launch cycle framework that AJ Giuliani and I co-created, you begin with the L, the look, listen, and learn, and you start from a place of student ownership there by tapping into their geeky interests, their questions, their prior knowledge. If they observe a natural phenomenon, you encourage them to jot down their findings. If they're building empathy with an audience, it's their observation. In other words, you are starting the project from a place of student agency. As they move into the L, so you have the L, look, listen, and learn, the A, ask tons of questions. Again, students are the ones asking the questions. Although you might provide some sentence stems and sample questions, you're asking them to self-select their scaffolding and figure out what they need. And even when this happens, you are encouraging them to be the ones to ask the questions. As you move into you, the understanding of the process and the problem, students are engaging in their own research. They take the questions that they've asked and they begin to find sources. They paraphrase the information. They figure it out. They navigate this whole research phase on their own. Students can also decide which strategy they want to use when they do research, including note-taking or spreadsheets or sketchnoting. They're determining which information is the most relevant to their future design. In other words, they own the entire research process. From there, they take that background knowledge and they navigate ideas. So they went from look, listen, and learn to asking their own questions, to understanding the process or problem through their own research lens, to now navigating ideas. And again, it's all about student ownership. Students generate their own ideas, they create their own project plan. And when this happens, you avoid that recipe problem that Chris Lehman mentioned. Now then, as they begin to create, they're engaging in their own prototyping process, but also their own project management process. And if you're interested at all, I have a blog post and a podcast episode that's all about how to help students own the project management process. And then the last one is highlight and fix. This is where you have students own the assessment process. They engage in self-assessment and peer assessment. And through this process, again, they begin to really revise their work. When we empower students to own this project process, we are increasing student buy-in. Students who might initially seem needy become confident as they internalize the reality that they are no longer working for their teacher. They're designing for themselves, or more importantly, they're designing for an authentic audience. Ownership also increases metacognition. And again, there's a blog post and a podcast all about metacognition if you're interested in it. Or you can check out that little sketch video that's inside of this blog post that goes with this podcast. So that's it. It starts with this place of ownership. Now, the next layer to think about is to incorporate interdependence. Now, the best projects are the ones where the group creates something way more awesome and epic than what any individual could have created on their own. And this, by the way, has been true in my own life. My favorite projects that I did. I did a children's book, for example, that I co-wrote with my wife. I co-wrote my last two books with my friend AJ. You know, my favorite projects have been the ones where I collaborated with someone else. I recently did a collaboration with Presto Plan's curriculum and this woman named Bonnie, and she's awesome. And we did these, you know, video prompts and these warm-ups for the beginning of the year. And again, we both created something together that we never would have been able to create on our own. And that's what you're going for. But that requires interdependency. And Interdependency requires you to design interdependent structures. Too often in group projects, one member works independently while other members are dependent on that single member, merely filling in the gaps when asked to help. But when you're working interdependently, each member is adding value to the group project. Interdependence begins with trust, with each member depending on each other to complete their tasks. So that's the idea of interdependency. Here's what it looks like. If students are brainstorming, you have them brainstorm on their own first, and then they meet as a group, and then they navigate the ideas together, and they combine ideas, they negotiate to figure it out, and there's a whole brainstorming strategy that begins with students working individually, then they work interdependently. And that's one example, that's brainstorm. If you use a jigsaw process as a part of your research process, well, now again, you're working interdependently because they have to depend on each other. When we would do inquiry and research as part of this launch process and a part of the project-based learning framework, this is the process that we use that built interdependency. So students would generate questions independently, so you have that built-in accountability. And then once they have their questions, they would send them on Google Form. And then the Google Form would have all of the questions for the whole group together. From there, each member is given a separate role. Member number one asks, is this question fact-based? Member number two asks, is this on topic? Member number three asks, is this question specific? And member number four is the quality control person. Now, what this does is, whether or not it's fact-based and on topic are things that a struggling student can still do. So they can still participate. They can still contribute to their group. Member number three and four, though, are often students who are kind of high achievers doing really well. And they still have to depend on the students who are, quote, low so that they can accomplish this task. So every student is depending on each other. They all have a separate responsibility and they're all contributing something to it, but it's at each student's ability level, or I should say skill level. And what happens is, you know, members number one, two, and three will then put a star next to each of the questions, or if it's a spreadsheet, they'll each have their own place where they put yes or no. And then if there's three yeses in a row next to the question, yes, yes, and yes, then member number four is the quality control person who decides ultimately if this is or is not a research question. And so that person has to learn how to be humble and depend on people who are maybe at a lower skill level than them, which can be a real challenge for some of our high achievers. Note that the struggling student might still be able to do jobs, not might, will have a chance to do jobs. And yet members number three and four also have jobs and responsibility, and everybody is learning how to trust one another and collaborate and listen and build empathy. So again, the bottom line is that as you're building projects, as you're designing them, you're creating these structures that allow each person to be responsible for a separate part, but then also to depend on others in order to accomplish their task. And so that's the idea of interdependent structures that you want to build into your projects. And then layer number three is this idea that you have to have structure. Although you don't want recipes, there's the opposite end of the spectrum that you can fall into, where you give students a project idea and say, go make a comic book, go, and then nothing happens, right? And this happened to me early on in my PBL journey. I would give students loose guidelines and then say, have at it, make it work, and then it didn't work. They actually didn't do any of the work at all. And I was always worried that providing structures was somehow artificial. It wasn't really authentic if they were using, you know, these creative structures or project structures. But the truth is, structures are vital for creative work. Anybody in any creative field regularly uses structures and protocols to do their work. They provide the necessary creative constraint that pushes divergent thinking. They help to actually facilitate the creative collaborative work. One of the fascinating things that I've learned in researching collaboration and innovation is just how often organizations and teams and companies use specific structures to facilitate their creative work. For example, Pixar uses the brain trust concept, and it's really similar to the ideas of radical candor. I love the book, by the way, by Kim Scott. And again, these structures helps people to give feedback to one another and to speak openly about their creative work. And the truth is, in nearly every discipline I've looked at, people use a framework or a blueprint for their creative work. And whether it's a writer's workshop or engineering process, scientific method, design thinking framework, they're always using a framework. When I have students do research, we have a very specific framework for critical reading. When we do feedback, we have a structure that is loosely based on the critical friend structure, and it involves students giving an elevator pitch, asking clarifying questions, getting feedback, paraphrase, and next steps. And so the idea is that these structures actually help creative work to thrive, and they allow students to work collaboratively because the structure facilitates it. The key thing, though, is that the structures have to honor student creativity and agency. They have to feel like they can still own the learning even when they are following a structure or a protocol. Note that ownership, interdependency, and structure all work together. The best structures incorporate all of these elements in a way that is seamless and interconnected. But even when it works, you're still going to have problems. Kids are still going to misbehave. They're sometimes going to fight, argue with each other. Sometimes a kid has a bad day. They just don't feel like working. Fear and insecurity will still creep in, especially in projects that they love. There is no magical formula to make creative collaboration work flawlessly because, newsflash, we are not flawless people. We are broken people in a broken world. But as the architect, you get to design the structures that build this creative collaboration among your students. It's not easy. It will never work perfectly, but ultimately it is totally worth it. Because in your class, they begin to learn those lifelong transferable skills of how to create and collaborate in project-based learning. So, the bottom line is this. You can make it happen by incorporating the structures that encourage your students to own their learning, to work interdependently, and to embrace the structures of creative collaboration. Hey, if you enjoy this podcast, would you do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher? Again, that would mean the world to me. So thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.